Cultural Journey with Toby Davey on RNIB Connect Radio.
Let's say goodbye with a smile, dear, just for a while, dear, we must part. Don't let this parting upset you, I'll not forget you, sweetheart. We'll meet again, don't know where. Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Hello, I'm Toby Davey, and welcome to A Cultural Journey, bringing heritage to life through audio description for blind and partially sighted people here on RNIB Connect Radio, as you join me for a tour of the Churchill War Rooms in central London with Oliver Carter Wakefield, curator of the CWR. Throughout my tour with Oliver, you will also hear clips from the recorded audio described guide to the Churchill War Rooms for blind and partially sighted people, which is available from the audio desk in the entrance to the CWR. And before I meet Oliver for my tour, here is part of the introduction from the recorded audio described guide, which I think sets the scene for the tour of the Churchill War Rooms.
This is a descriptive tour of the Churchill War Rooms, a secret underground headquarters that operated throughout the Second World War. You're now going to explore this extraordinary hidden site and walk in the footsteps of Winston Churchill and the many other men and women who worked, ate, and even slept here during the war. Most of the rooms we'll visit are more or less as they were when the war ended in 1945, as if we have stepped back in time.
You join me here on RNIB Connect Radio underground in Westminster in central London at the Churchill War Rooms, the secret sort of rooms where Churchill and his inner circle sort of defined and, I suppose, steered the war as well. And I'm with Oliver Carter Wakefield, who is the curator of the Churchill War Rooms. Oliver, before we sort of go on a little bit of a tour of the rooms and find out a little bit more about the life of the people who worked down here, do tell me a little bit about Churchill, the icon, and the man behind the icon as well, because he came from, I suppose, a bit of a privileged sort of a background. His father was a politician, and his mother was the daughter of an American businessman. So he had a bit of a privileged life, but he was sort of, I suppose, not really sort of given that much of a privileged life. He went off to boarding school and went into the army, but he was always sort of had his sights on becoming a politician.
Yes, it's a life that's characterised by great determination. Some of the early photographs of Churchill, you can really get a sense that he's determined to make something of himself. And indeed, he did very rapidly. He entered Parliament as a Conservative MP for Oldham in 1900, and then very famously crossed the floor to join the Liberal Party a few years later, where he became involved in, some may find it surprising given his later reputation, but he was very involved in the radical politics of the time. And he worked with Lloyd George to try and successfully pass through the People's Budget. He left the Liberal Party in the 1920s, but he'd had a significant experience of office before that. He was the youngest cabinet member appointed since the 1860s, when he assumed his first cabinet position, which was as president of the Board of Trade. He was subsequently First Lord of the Admiralty during the First World War, then Secretary of State for Munitions, Secretary of State for both War and Air, Secretary of State for the Colonies, and finally, after rejoining the Conservative Party in the 1920s, he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, and then began what is often referred to as his wilderness years.
And of course, you know, Churchill, it was very much sort of he was, I suppose, in some ways warning people a little bit about Hitler and what was possibly going to come, but people didn't really sort of, I suppose, acknowledge that until, you know, things became a little bit truer and, you know, he did become Prime Minister.
Well, he was very far-sighted in recognising the danger of German rearmament and the inherent inhumanity in Nazism. And yes, as the 1930s progressed, he became the figurehead of the anti-appeasement movement. His house at Chartwell was very much a headquarters as well as a home in which people who were anti-Nazi journalists and politicians came and visited him. Indeed, Albert Einstein visited him in 1933 to talk about his recent experience of persecution under the Nazis. So Churchill was someone who really saw the danger that was rising in the 1930s, at a time when many people in Britain didn't.
And do you think, I suppose, being Prime Minister during the Second World War sort of made him as a man?
That's a very good question. I would say that he was very well made before then. I think it's the characteristics that define his personality that made him such an effective war leader. The determination, the self-belief. In terms of the discussions that were sometimes held in the war cabinet room, they were often quite tempestuous, and Churchill deployed a whole battery of rhetorical devices in terms of making his point. Admiral Godfrey, who was the head of naval intelligence and who M in the James Bond novels is based on, described Churchill using flattery, insults, mockery, sometimes stony silence, perhaps more rarely, and sometimes even tears in trying to make his arguments. But he was also, despite his love for action, which is very much a characteristic of his personality, and the chiefs of staff often had to argue against some of the decisions that he wished that they would make. I think it's important to realise that despite his position as both Prime Minister and Minister of Defence, he didn't have the ability to impose his will upon the chiefs of staff. Despite their fear that he would sometimes lead them off in sort of rash directions, we should also remember that one of his great achievements as a war leader in 1942 was dissuading the Americans from launching a premature invasion of France, which would have been a disaster.
Well, let's now take a walk to the cabinet war room and we'll find out a little bit more there.
The war cabinet. We are in the basement of a purpose-built government building where the British government set up this secret underground headquarters in 1938. It was a place for key political and military leaders to safely work when the expected war with Nazi Germany began. This room is as it would have been during the war. In May 1940, after he became Prime Minister, Winston Churchill entered this room and said, "This is the room from which I will direct the war." 117 cabinet meetings were held on site during the war. There is one entrance door in the left-hand wall. It would have been guarded at all times when meetings were held in here. This large room is almost completely taken up by tables arranged in a square formation, covered in dark beige cloth, with a space in the middle. A huge world map hangs on the back wall. The lighting is dim. Seven white glass shades hanging from the low ceiling, casting pools of light. There are 20 chairs around the outer edges of the tables, each with a rectangle of blotting paper in front of it and a pencil. The chairs are metal, with black padded seats, backs and arms, except for Winston Churchill's chair, which is polished wood with curved arms. This is in the central position on the far side of the square. It's back to the world map. There's a large red metal dispatch case, like a ministerial briefcase, on the table in front of it. A gap between the tables nearest to us creates a path to three chairs that stand in the middle of the square to be occupied by the Prime Minister's chiefs of staff. The heads of the Army, Royal Navy, and Royal Air Force sat facing him. Small desks in the far corners of the room were occupied by secretaries keeping notes, who were always men. In total, there were usually at least 20 men in the room during meetings. But even with the seats empty, the room seems claustrophobic, the cream-painted brick walls doing little to brighten the heavy atmosphere, accentuated by the cream metal ducting and thick red girders running across the ceiling. One of Churchill's signature cigars lies in an ashtray by his chair, and more metal ashtrays are laid out along the tables, reminding us how most people would have smoked during the meetings. The small fans on the wall and the air ducts would have made little difference to the thick, smoky atmosphere. The War Cabinet met here throughout the Blitz, Germany's bombing campaign against the United Kingdom, as well as later in the war, when Germany's V weapons, V1 flying bombs and V2 rockets, attacked London. Meetings could last for hours and were sometimes very tense. Viscount Halifax, the Foreign Secretary, recorded in his diary that the meeting on the 28th of October 1940 was rather sharp-tempered.
So we are now in the Cabinet War Room. Oliver, do tell me a little bit about what sort of was going on in this particular room, because I believe Churchill was sort of holding court here.
Well, some people certainly thought so. So in terms of the layout of the room, there are three chairs which face the Prime Minister's chair, Churchill's chair, and that's where the chiefs of staff, the heads of the Army, Air Force and Navy sat. And it's perhaps being slightly facetious, but there is a sort of air of naughty schoolboys facing the headmaster about it. Churchill, well, we're familiar with his style, rhetorical style, as an orator. To be in a meeting with him was sometimes described as being like being in a battle. Leslie Haubalicia, who was a cabinet colleague during the Chamberlain government, said that Churchill arrived with his tactics in mind, armed with his facts, and he was either going to attempt to sort of beat you down into submission rhetorically. So yes, and the tension that was sometimes present in these meetings, cabinet meetings could last between 5 or 6 hours, is really evident in the fact that on Churchill's chair, which is a slightly different chair to the other ones around the room, sometimes referred to as a grandfather chair in terms of the style, it's a very Edwardian piece of furniture. And the arms of the chair bear signs of the tension of these meetings. On one side, we have the marks that were made by his signet ring banging into the arm of the chair. And on the other side, we have where his thumb left a little indentations, which really gives you a sense of the atmosphere. It would have also been, it's worth saying, an incredibly smoky atmosphere. Churchill would have obviously been smoking his cigars, but given the habits of the day, there would also have been a lot of pipe and cigarette smoke. There is a story, possibly apocryphal, that Churchill would discard his cigars into the fire bucket that is strategically placed behind his chair, and that the marine orderlies who were responsible for cleaning this room, because ordinary cleaners weren't allowed inside, given the sensitive nature of what was being discussed, that they would fish them out and then try and sell them at the pub. Not sure if it's true, but it's a great story.
And it's interesting that you mentioned the Marines, because I think this room was guarded by Royal Marines just to ensure that unauthorised people weren't able to get in and people weren't able to listen in to the conversations that were happening in here.
Yes, access would have been very restricted, and the site was guarded internally by Royal Marines, the majority of whom were pensioners who'd been recalled to the service. They didn't live on site. They lived at home and commuted in. And yes, it was their job to guard the site, also to provide cleaning for the cabinet room, and also to man the officers' mess.
And I suppose quite intense meetings in here as well, when they were talking about, you know, sort of defending the country and everything else, and tactics as well as, you know, sort of what they might do against the enemy.
Very much so. So some of the most pivotal decisions of the war would have been taken within this room, would have been discussed within this room. We know that there were 115 cabinet meetings held in this room, and that the majority of those were held during the Blitz and then also during the V-weapon attacks of 1944 and 1945. There were periods when it wasn't in huge amount of use. For example, I think in 1943, there were only 5 meetings held here. But whether or not there was an air raid on would have been indicated by a red or green light. Where we're standing now is actually only roughly 10 feet underground. So the level of protection that it would have offered is Well, it's open to question, shall we say.
Well, shall we take a walk along the corridor and go to room 63, which I think is a very sort of secret room in the war rooms, and one which possibly has a sort of double purpose, perhaps. But shall we have a walk along the corridor? And I think there's some things on our way which we might be able to discuss at the same time.
Yes, let's do that.
A cultural journey on RNIB Connect Radio.
A corridor several metres wide stretches away from you. You may hear recordings of footsteps, voices, and someone whistling. There's an institutional atmosphere, the brick walls covered with thick cream paint, dark wooden lockers against the right-hand wall, and metal coat hooks in alcoves on the left. The light is dingy. The ceiling feels oppressively low, with thick metal girders painted dull red. Cream-painted air ducts, up to half a metre wide, snake their way along the ceiling and continue throughout the site. The ducts were installed to bring in fresh air and had valves that could be closed to protect the air supply in the event of a gas attack.
As we're walking down the corridor, Oliver, to room 63, we've come across, I think, what's termed as the weather board, which had sort of, I suppose, indications of what the weather would be like upstairs or outside during the sort of the daytime and everything else, and during bombing raids as well. And I think the term windy had two different meanings.
Yes, indeed. There were some members of staff who would be working down here for up to 14 hours a day, and they wouldn't get a sense of what the weather was outside. So this was, you could call it a sort of 1940s version of a weather app. George Rance, who's a very interesting figure in the history of the war rooms, was responsible for changing it. And he would, when an air raid was on, change it to windy, which in 1940s slang was when someone was sort of seen as being a bit cowardly. They were referred to as having the wind up. So that was, it was a little in-joke to signify that.
And he was quite a character, wasn't he?
He certainly was a really remarkable individual and someone whose life was changed by his involvement with the CWR. So he was an official for the Ministry of Works, and amongst his various roles was ordering furniture for offices across Whitehall. He was also responsible for paying the cleaners in the Office of Works building, the very building that is above us. Because of this role, he was an ideal person to have furniture, when they were furnishing the site, have furniture sent to, because it was expected that it would be sent to him. So he was a sort of cover for the war rooms as it was being set up in 1938-1939. He retired in the spring of 1939, and he was rather dramatically called out of retirement in August 1938, and he was the custodian of the war rooms throughout the war, and indeed he was the site's first curator. He led tours round throughout the 1950s, and he attended Churchill's funeral in 1965. He was in his 90s then, and having had a look through his correspondence, it's very clear that it's very important for him to make the pilgrimage, as it were, to attend that funeral.
So I think a lot of people who worked down here were very sort of loyal to Churchill, weren't they?
Yes, indeed they were. And also very loyal to George Rance. He engendered a real sense of affection amongst the staff. And he's really a father figure within the war rooms. The novelist Dennis Wheatley, who some of your listeners might be familiar with as an author of sort of, well, one of his films was made into a Hammer horror potboiler in the 1950s called The Devil Rides Out. He worked down here during the war, and he wrote to Rance to thank him for his kindness and his patience. He was having to deal with a huge number of people competing for a very small amount of space. It's one of the remarkable things about this site, the way it evolved from a site that could initially accommodate between 50 and 60 people to roughly 500 by the war's end.
Well, let's carry on down the corridor and let's find this room 63, which, as I mentioned, has possibly two different purposes, or one purpose, but a secret purpose.
You're now standing at the heart of the site. In a moment, we'll leave this corridor, going through the doorways on the left. But before we do, we'll tell you about an important door, 6 metres further on the left. It's white, with number 63 on it. The door has "Keep Locked" written on it. During the war, people who worked here were told this door led to Churchill's private toilet, but its real purpose was kept secret. Above the door handle, there's even a circular brass, engaged, vacant sign, like you would find on a public toilet. Today, it reads, "Engaged."
So, Oliver, we're now standing in front of room 63, which, if people were walking past during the time of the Second World War down here working, they would just sort of think it's Churchill's private toilet. But it had a different purpose, didn't it?
Well, there was a lack of plumbing on site. And given Churchill's liking for the finer things in life, it would be unsurprising that he might have his own personal toilet installed down here. But as you say, this door, which it bears a normal sort of lavatory sign of engaged, unoccupied, but it had a very different purpose. This was the doorway to the transatlantic telephone room, which was the room where Churchill was able to talk to President Roosevelt using a really remarkable system, which I could tell you a bit more about.
Yeah.
So the system was called SigSally, and it was developed in 1941, 1942 by Bell Telephone Laboratories. And you'll be familiar with scrambler telephone technology. Well, that actually, some people would describe that more as a sort of privacy device rather than an encryption device. A really skilled interceptor would actually be able to decipher conversation on a scrambler phone. SigSally is actually a voice synthesizer. So it breaks down the patterns in the human voice at the rate of 50 instances per second. It breaks them down, and then they would be coded, sent across the Atlantic, and then reassembled almost in real time on the other side, which, given the period we're talking about, this is really remarkable technology. So it was actually a voice synthesizer. And there's a great story. Apparently, one occasion, Roosevelt picked up the phone and burst out laughing as soon as he heard Churchill, because Churchill sounded like Donald Duck.
I suppose it's a bit like sort of encryption of WhatsApp, isn't it?
Possibly, yes, yeah. As you can imagine, such an amazing piece of technology, it required a huge amount of kit, shall we say. There was no way that that could be stored on site. And indeed, at the American end of things in Washington, there was no way in which that could be stored in the White House. So in America, the SigSally equipment was in the Pentagon. Here, it was in the basement of Selfridge's department store.
That's quite incredible to think, isn't it?
Yes, but it also makes sense. I mean, if you think of Selfridge's proximity to the American embassy. And so from the Selfridge's basement, there were three extension lines running out from there. One terminated where we're standing now. One led to 10 Downing Street, and one was used by the American Embassy. SigSally was installed and ready for use by August 1943. But the first discussion that we know of that Roosevelt and Churchill had was in April 1944, the following year.
At the far end is a room the size of a broom cupboard, which in fact is what it once was. Here, there is a desk that faces away from us, tucked under two empty shelves. On the desk, a small lamp with a green glass shade. The figure of Churchill occupies the space. This private cupboard was where Churchill spoke with the President of the United States in complete secrecy. He used a special telephone system known as SigSally. This was a secure system developed for the US Armed Forces. Each SigSally terminal was expensive, and transporting one across the Atlantic was risky. The fact that America installed one in London demonstrates the importance of the special relationship between Britain and the US. American signals officer Stephen Guise installed the equipment and remembered meeting Churchill.
He said, "Oh, you may stay if you wish." And I said, "No, I don't think I'd better, Mr. Churchill, but if you would accept a cigar from me, it would make me very happy." And he said, "Well, I certainly will." And he took the cigar.
Churchill and President Roosevelt first spoke via SigSally in April 1944. Later, after Roosevelt died, Churchill and President Truman also used it. And in April 1945, They discussed the end of the war in Europe for 2 hours.
And it's quite interesting hearing the whistling in the background again, because that reminds us about how much Churchill likes silence. And I think all the typists who were typing up reports and minutes down here had silent typewriters. And I think they came from America as well.
Yes. Well, I think Remington was one of the first companies to introduce the noiseless typewriter. And it's interesting to think about Churchill's work as a writer. It's often said that he wrote more than Shakespeare and Dickens combined, more published words, that is. But he actually very rarely put pen, or should we say typewriter key, to paper. His style of writing was to dictate, and various people who worked as his secretaries have some fantastic stories about that. And looked at in that perspective, you can understand why he would hate the noise of typewriters, because it would put him off his flow whilst he was pacing the room and dictating.
Well, let's carry on our tour. And I think we're going to probably go and have a look at Churchill's family rooms down here. So I know we're sort of a little bit more further into Churchill's rooms at the moment, and around us we've got things like his dining room and his cook's room as well, and also Mrs. Churchill's room as well. It must have been, I suppose, quite strange for them sort of coming down here to sort of eat and possibly sleep.
Well, in October 1940, a bomb fell on Treasury Green, which is just at the top of Downing Street, and both 10 Downing Street and number 11 were incredibly badly damaged. So number 10 Downing Street wasn't really habitable after that. Certain rooms, such as the garden rooms downstairs, were continued to be used. But the Churchills moved into what was referred to as the number 10 Annex. And that was the ground floor of the building that's above us, the new public offices. And they had a suite of rooms up there. As the Blitz intensified, it was seen as a sensible precautionary move to replicate or to build a suite of rooms in the CWR itself. So a kitchen was constructed, a private dining room, a room for the Prime Minister's wife, Clementine Churchill, and also extra rooms for some members of Churchill's entourage. For example, Brendan Bracken, very close confidant, Minister of Information, he had a room down here. And also Desmond Morton, who's a really interesting figure, who was sort of Churchill's liaison with the intelligence services during the earlier stages of the war.
And it must have been quite sort of, I suppose, you know, sort of quite sort of, I suppose, constrained in many ways when you think of the amount of people who must have been down here at that time. You know, it must have been quite maybe slightly claustrophobic kind of experience.
Yes. The novelist Anthony Powell, who worked here during the war, he, in one of his novels, has a scene in which the CWR is described, and the character talks about it as if he's going down into the bowels of a ship. And the site really does have that feel to it. And the corridor that we walked down earlier, that would often be used as an overflow space for typists. So it would have been a really, really cramped site. But you have to think that that reflects London at that particular time. The damage caused by the Blitz obviously reduces the amount of space that's available. But you also have a huge influx as the war progresses of representatives from the governments of occupied countries. You have American service personnel. So space is really at a premium. And there are discussions throughout the war about, can more space be found? And you sort of get the sense that the representative from the Office of Works, Eric de Norman, is somewhat long-suffering. He's very accommodating in terms of finding more space for the staff down here, but he really is quite hard pushed, and they are forced to give up some quite important space for them. The cabinet room that we were in earlier was, in fact, originally air raid shelter for the Office of Works staff, but they were forced to give that up in 1939.
And there's another meeting room, which we can hear probably a little bit of audio in the background from, the Chief of Staff's meeting room, which was very different to the War Cabinet room.
Yes, one might say that the atmosphere in there was perhaps a little calmer. But yes, in terms of the organizations and subcommittees that would have used the site. There's a great deal. The chiefs of staff would have met down here. There would have also been the joint planning and joint intelligence sections. The planning section had its own intelligence section, confusingly. It also had a future planning section. And then there was the London controlling section, who the aforementioned Dennis Wheatley worked for. They were involved in planning deception operations, one of the most famous being Operation Bodyguard, which was the strategic sort of over operation. There were other operations that were part of it that protected the Normandy landings, the planning for the Normandy landings.
And the war rooms were extended, weren't they, as well, and also fortified just in case of invasion. And as well as the Marines who were down here, there were Grenadine Guards, and also some of the officers who were working down here would have served in the, you know, sort of maybe World War One as well. So they would have been able to defend the war rooms if needed.
Yes, there would have been a lot of individuals who'd had direct experience of combat on site. And the Churchill becomes Prime Minister on May the 10th, the day after the German army invades the Low Countries. And airborne troops, parachute, and to a lesser extent, glider-borne troops play a significant part in that operation. And the following day, Churchill issues an order that the defence of Whitehall against parachute attack should be looked into and the defences should be bolstered. So yes, you're absolutely right. There were the Marines on site who would have been armed. There were also, it was referred to in homage to George Rance, 12 Grenadier Guards, a sergeant corporal and 10 guardsmen. They were referred to as Rance's guard, and one of them would have been on duty at the main entrance at all times. Had the site come under attack, you would have heard a continuous klaxon blast for 2 minutes. And if that sounded, the instructions were that all soldiers and officers who were on site, including the very senior officers who potentially would have been here in a cabinet meeting or in the chief of staff's room, would assemble in front of the map room and they would arm themselves. They'd be split into two groups who would then defend the site.
Well, shall we sort of walk towards the map room? And on our way, I think there's a model we can explore, which might give me a little bit more of an insight into sort of how close the war rooms were to the building above us and everything else.
I think that sounds like a very good idea. Let's go.
A cultural journey on RNIB Connect Radio.
So, Oliver, we're now standing in front of a model of the building and the war rooms, which I think is maybe a sort of cross-section of how things were and how deep the war rooms were beyond or below the building. Just explain to me what's in front of me.
So there's a sort of relief model in front of you. The lower half of it is a cross-section of the war rooms. It's illuminated. You can see some of the supports, but it really gives you an idea of just how close to the surface the war rooms really were. And it's fascinating, in post-war memoirs or recollections, when people visit the site, they often talk about, oh, we were hundreds of feet below Whitehall. As I mentioned earlier, that was the initial plan for government shelter in Whitehall, but it really wasn't the case here. We're looking at roughly 10 foot of space separating where we are from the floor above. The building itself, the new public offices, the reason it has that name is in contrast to the old public offices, which are across the way where the Foreign Office is housed. They were built, the construction started in the late 19th century, was finished in 1917. And you have two very grand buildings which are connected. And in the middle, there's a wonderful central courtyard, which is actually based on Inigo Jones's never realized designs for the Palace of Westminster. The building was built with a steel frame, which is one of the reasons why it was chosen in 1938, because it was thought that of all the buildings in the Whitehall area, this probably had the best chance of surviving a direct hit by a bomb. Thankfully, it was never tested.
Which is incredible to think that, you know, in the centre of London and there are no hits on the building.
Yes, there were some very close calls. Very famously and tragically, in June 1944, a flying bomb fell on the Guards Chapel, which is just down the road from where we're standing, and killed 121 people. And the impact from that blast was felt down here. But yes, there are some close calls, and we can have a look at those on the model behind us.
Let's turn around and have a look at the model, which gives us a better sense of sort of how close things were. So, Oliver, we are now in front of a sort of model which actually depicts how close all the bombs were, and also, I suppose, gives us a better sort of idea of how close to the river the buildings were and whereabouts in central London we are.
Yes, it gives you an idea of one of the reasons why this site was selected, because it is so close to the centre of power. It's the Houses of Parliament are just around the corner. It's very close to Number 10. Across the other side of Horse Guards Parade, you would have the Admiralty. And then at the top of St. James's Park is Buckingham Palace.
So all very close. And I can actually touch, can't I?
Mm, please do.
So if I put my hand out, whereabouts roughly are we?
So we're in the centre of the table.
Okay, so if I put my hand a bit further, further forward. So gosh, quite a long way. Yep.
Yeah.
and it's a
and there are marks of bomb blasts.
Okay. There's a crater. Yes. Yep. Got to that. Yep.
And if you see, just here,
there's another one. Yes.
Yep. So. Those are bomb craters.
Yep.
And then we are there.
My goodness.
And that's just crossing the road there.
Oh, good Lord. So it's incredibly close.
Very much so. Very much so. Churchill supposedly said that he thought it was a pity that bombs didn't fall any closer, because he would have liked to have had a chance to test the site's defences. A very typically Churchillian comment.
Well, shall we now take a walk into, I suppose, the real heart of the war rooms, which was the map room. And on our way, we'll probably pass the BBC radio broadcast room where Churchill's speeches to the nation were broadcast from the war rooms.
Yes, if you'd just like to follow me, we'll just go down here.
The map room operated 24/7 from August 1939 until August 1945. That's over 2,000 days. Today, it's exactly as it was left when the war ended. It's as if the people who worked here have just left the room. The room is cluttered and dingy, in spite of the white-painted wooden pillars. Maps cover almost every bit of available wall. Office furniture fills every space, and stacks of box files and paper are everywhere. There are only narrow pathways between it all for people to move around. The staff worked in shifts, and included plotters and clerks, as well as the officers, who were nicknamed the Glamour Boys. In the centre of the room are five large wooden desks with green tops, behind each a black metal upholstered chair with arms. Four of them are arranged in pairs facing each other to form a large rectangle, with the fifth across the right-hand end. Attached to the end nearest to us is a bookshelf, filled with dog-eared books. Running between the two pairs of desks is a raised shelf with 10 phones, in easy reach of anyone at the desks. They're in various colours. Four are cream, two green, one red, and three are black with a green receiver. There are large light bulbs between them. These are the scrambler phones, which were called the Beauty Chorus, because the bulbs lit up instead of the phones ringing to reduce noise levels. The desks are covered with papers and files, equipped with a metal anglepoise lamp and a cane waste paper basket on the floor. There's also one small, crumpled piece with several sugar lumps nestled on it. At the end of the war, the staff turned out the lights and left, and this remarkable room was locked up. But Wing Commander John Hegarty, one of the duty officers here, accidentally left his week's sugar ration behind. Further back in the room, behind the desks and attached to a pillar, is a dark metal pipe known as a Lamson tube. It's bent into a U-shape, about a metre high, with another section of pipe disappearing up through the ceiling. The brown metal Lamson tubes quickly transported messages around Westminster using compressed air. The largest of the maps covers almost all of the left-hand wall. It's covered with clusters of small buff-coloured cards, about 12 centimetres high. Each has a place name on it with its location. Nearest to the glass, the cards include Kingston and Trinidad, and higher up are Bermuda and Halifax. Some of them have coloured pins stuck in them. A notice near the top of the map reads, "Each pinpoint represents a convoy movement." The thousands of pinholes in it chart the movement of every naval convoy. The Atlantic is densely covered in them. The battle there was crucial and fiercely fought as Allied ships sailed in convoy to deliver men and material all round the world. Until the British broke the German submarine Enigma codes in 1943, the casualty rates here were punishing. The maproom staff gathered information and plotted it on these maps to keep the War Cabinet and Chiefs of Staff up to date in the vast global war. Joan Bright noted, "Daily truth belonged to the maproom. It was our one centre of fact." Every morning, a report was compiled for the King, Prime Minister, Chiefs of Staff, and War Cabinet. The entire war was plotted in this room, from early battles in Europe to the surrender of Japanese forces in the Pacific. It was the nerve centre, and Churchill visited often. Important visitors included King George VI and General Eisenhower. General Ismay called the map room a haunt of intense interest and great friendliness, and Wing Commander Hegarty organised lively post-war reunions of its staff. They knew everything that went on in the war, good and bad. Just one example. In April 1941, reports reached the map room that German armoured trains were moving away from the scene of expected operations in Greece and instead heading north to Poland. Leslie Hollis remembered, "Churchill had decided this could only mean that a German attack on Russia was imminent, and decided to warn Stalin immediately and personally of the danger." This room, and the secrets it held, really were at the heart of Britain's global war. A blackboard attached to a pillar to the right of the room shows how many German aircraft the RAF were reported to have shot down on one day in the Battle of Britain. To the right of it, nearer to the glass, the clock hanging on the pillar has a large V on its clock face.
So, Oliver, we are now in the heart of the war rooms, the map room, and around us are lots of maps on the walls, many, many maps. And also, there would have been lots of people working down here 24 hours a day and on shifts, so people coming in and out, very busy, but very important place.
Very much so. This is really the nerve centre of the war rooms. When the idea of establishing an emergency war headquarters was mooted in 1938, it was decided that it would serve two key purposes. One we've already discussed, which was to provide a safe meeting place for the War Cabinet. The other was to be a real nexus, a centre point where information could be collated. So the war rooms wasn't a site where operations were ordered to be set into motion from, but it was a site where information was collated and decisions were made. And the map room was the real epicentre of that. This is where the most up-to-date information on the state of the war was telephoned into, and where it was recorded on the maps that surround us. And in the centre of the room, there is a long table on which there is a row of coloured telephones. This is often referred to as the beauty chorus, and that was the route by which information came in to the map room. So there are two green telephones. There are also two black telephones with green receivers. These are scrambler phones. There are five white telephones and one red telephone, which is right in the centre of the table. Looks very dramatic. That was the direct line to the Joint Chiefs of Staff room that we've just visited. And to lessen the noise, because potentially this could be a very, very busy place at times when lots of information was coming in, the telephones wouldn't always ring. There were lights next to them, which would be illuminated when a call was coming in. There's also a set of pneumatic tubes, which people who've perhaps worked in shops will be familiar with in the days when cash was more common, commonly used to send change around the stores. They were installed in February 1940. And James Lesor, in his book about Leslie Hollis's war experience called War at the Top, he speculates that they run beneath the whole of Whitehall. They may well do, we don't know. The particular ones in this room, we can say that they were installed in February 1940. And their purpose, originally at least, was to connect this war room with the Air Ministry war room, which was actually in the same building, the other side of the new public offices, which is sometimes referred to as the Charles Street building. The atmosphere in this room would often have been very tense. To our left, there is a board in which convoy positions were mapped. And that is a board which is absolutely saturated with tiny pinpricks, each pinprick representing a convoy. And you can imagine, particularly during the darkest days of the Battle of the Atlantic, when constant losses were being telephoned into this room from the Admiralty, the atmosphere that would have developed from that news.
And I suppose quite sort of hard for the people working here to have that news sort of firsthand and to, you know, sort of know what was actually really happening out there. And it must have affected them.
I'm sure it did. Very hard to maintain one's composure in those circumstances. And although the war rooms was obviously a site in which the war could sometimes seem removed physically, you're safe or relatively safe from it, it was also a site in which the reality of it was really brought home in terms of rooms like this. You really got a sense of how well or how badly things were going.
And it's incredible also to think that this room is almost exactly how it was when the lights were turned off and the door was shut.
Yes, so this room became operational in August 1939, and it remained operational, ran 24 hours a day on a shift system. There would have normally been at least four military officers on shift at any one time. And the room was operational until August 1945, when the lights were turned off, and it was left very much as it was. And when the museum took over the site in the 1980s and conducted an incredibly thorough inventory, they actually found three sugar cubes, which constituted one of the officers who worked here, sugar ration, still in the envelope that they'd been put in by him in a drawer, the desk where he worked.
That's incredible. Well, we're going to probably end our tour with a visit to Churchill's bedroom itself. So shall we move round there?
It's just down here, so if you'd like to follow me.
We're now viewing Winston Churchill's bedroom, where he slept several times during the Blitz. The head of the bed is against the left-hand wall, with a green quilted cover. Apart from the bed and the rug covering the floor, this could almost be another map room. Maps cover every wall, showing Britain's defences. There are also curtains, which could be pulled across when anyone came in who shouldn't see them. Churchill also used this room as an office, often holding meetings with key staff. There's a large, polished desk at the back of the room, and armchairs upholstered in green velvet set back against the right and left walls. Churchill would dictate to his secretaries while lying on the bed. His private secretary, Jock Colville, said,
"And I remember vividly going into his bedroom one evening just when Neville Chamberlain died, and he was dictating a very moving speech. He dictated quite a lot of his speeches from that room."
Churchill would often take naps here, but it wasn't quite up to his standards. There's a chamber pot just poking out under the end of the bed. There was no plumbing down here, so he couldn't have his two daily baths. Churchill could be a demanding boss, but his staff held him in high regard. After he lost the July 1945 general election, War Room Secretary Olive Christopher wrote, "When we lost Churchill as our leader, it was, to everyone here, a personal loss, and we miss his inspiration and leadership more than we can ever express." There are microphones on the desk. Winston Churchill made 4 BBC radio addresses from this room, and his wife, Clemmie, made 17 appeals for the Aid to Russia Fund she chaired. On the 11th of September 1940, Churchill spoke to the nation from that desk, while Britain faced the threat of German invasion.
"These cruel, wanton, indiscriminate bombings of London are, of course, a part of Hitler's invasion plan. What he has done is to kindle a fire in British hearts, here and all over the world, which will glow long after all traces of the conflagrations he has caused in London have been removed. He has lighted a fire which will burn with a steady and consuming flame until the last vestiges of Nazi tyranny have been burnt out of Europe."
So we are now standing in front of Churchill's bedroom, and this is very interesting in many ways, because not only did Churchill sort of, he was down here and this was his bedroom where he slept. He didn't really sleep that often, did he?
So yes, Churchill didn't particularly enjoy sleeping down here. As far as we know, he only spent 3 nights down here. He much preferred to be on the Air Ministry roof watching the bombing as it was taking place. And there's a story that his bodyguard recounts of Clementine Churchill telling her husband that he really needed to look after himself and make use of the bedroom that he had down here and sleep down here. Churchill, with a mischievous grin on his face, one evening followed Thompson down. An air raid was developing. They gathered up papers. Thompson led him downstairs, made sure he had everything he needed, and was about to turn off the light when Churchill said, "Oh no, you can leave it on, it's fine." Thompson went to his own room, and a few minutes later, the buzzer rang. It was called back into Churchill's bedroom, and Churchill said, "Thompson, I've obeyed my wife. I've come down here to go to bed, and now I'm going to go upstairs to sleep."
So quite incredible, isn't it? And his bedroom was the place where he actually did those live broadcasts, wasn't it, as well?
Yes, it was also his study down here, and the facilities existed on site for him to broadcast from either this room or from the cabinet room. But as far as we know, as far as we understand, the 4 broadcasts referred to earlier took place in this room. And it was also a room that Clementine Churchill used for her own radio broadcasts as chairperson for the Red Cross Aid to Russia Fund.
And she made more broadcasts than Churchill, didn't she?
We believe so, yes. Yes, certainly from this room.
And obviously, you know, it is a bedroom. It's got a bed in it and everything else, but it's also got maps around the room. You were saying about his, I suppose, obsession with maps, but in his bedroom he had maps.
Yes, well, these are actually a legacy of this room was at one point the headquarters for Home Forces. So the maps which show the defensive state of Britain in 1940 are actually a legacy of that period. The walls where the maps are pinned are covered by curtains, and that's so that the maps could be, which really the most sensitive information available in 1940, that they could be covered at a moment's notice. But Churchill had his own map room upstairs in the number 10 annex. He also had his own sort of small travelling map room that he insisted was set up wherever he went. And apparently President Roosevelt was very enamoured by this and insisted that his own was created. But yes, Churchill had a huge fondness for maps, and that may well have dated from his time as First Sea Lord. There's also a story of map room set up at the Admiralty during the First World War.
And what do you think we can sort of learn from sort of coming down here and experiencing the war rooms and finding out a little bit more about Churchill, the icon and his life?
So I think we can learn a lot about Churchill as an individual from the site. But I think it's also important to remember that whilst he, we know he spent 3 nights down here and attended war cabinet meetings, there are a huge number of people for whom this site was their daily working environment. They would have to be down here for huge extended stretches of time without the luxury of being able to go upstairs to the number 10 annex. So whilst Churchill is a central to the story of the CWR. I think it's important that we remember the huge number of other people who worked here.
Well, to find out more about the Churchill War Rooms and for details about the recorded audio described guide, do go to iwm.org.uk/visits/Churchill-War-Rooms. Oliver, thank you very much indeed for a wonderful tour of the Churchill War Rooms and give me a little bit of background not only to Churchill but to the men and women who worked down here underground in the war rooms during World War II.
It's been a pleasure, Toby.
What an amazing tour of the Churchill War Rooms that was, and thanks again to Oliver for taking me round and giving me a real insight into the lives of some of the people who worked alongside Churchill in the CWR during World War II. If you have an interest in military history and the life of Winston Churchill too, I would definitely recommend visiting the Churchill War Rooms and exploring the CWR with the recorded audio described guide. To find out more about the Churchill War Rooms and the recorded audio described guide, do go to iwm.org.uk/visits/Churchill-War-Rooms. Well, thank you so much for joining me here on RNIB Connect Radio for a cultural journey and the tour of the Churchill War Rooms with Oliver Carter Wakefield, curator of the CWR.
There'll be blue. Why?